I think the key, though, is to take the pressure off of yourself because the fact is, it's a first draft and it's not going to be good. It's not going to be together, and you're certainly not going to submit that. So, right there, the moment you know that you're not going to submit that, nobody's going to read that, it's for you to find your way through the story. That first draft is your opportunity to make tons of mistakes, to make a big old mess, to use your delete key liberally, and to figure out what it really is that you want to say. What is the story really about? Where are you really going? Why does this matter? And all of that is stuff that you're going to start to figure out in the first draft.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence. You're listening to episode 68 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng. Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? If you're looking for a safe space to check in about your writing and hang out with other fellow storytellers, come join us over at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. Before we get into today's interview, I wanted to thank Vermont College of Fine Arts for sponsoring today's episode. They're the first low residency MFA program in the country to focus exclusively on writing for young readers. At the end of the show, you'll find out why they're ranked one of the best low residency writing programs in the country. We have number one New York Times bestselling award-winning author Allison Noel on the show today. Allison has published 23 novels, including The Immortals, The Riley Bloom, and The Soul Seeker series. We get really up close and personal in today's episode. Allison has gone through more loss than most people would in a lifetime. She shares her experiences struggling with grief and how she coped with it through writing. Allison also shares in detail how to create dynamic personalities for your characters, where to find inspiration for story ideas, and how to create a flexible writing outline to keep your progress on track. This episode especially hits the spot if you're coming across some challenges in your first draft. Fellow NaNoWriMo participants will definitely want to dive into Allison's words of advice. We really dive deep into the topic of surviving the first draft, how to eliminate the pressure of perfection, and how to structure scenes so that you can avoid dead spots. Now let's jump right in. I am so excited to have you on the show. You are so lovely, and I would love to just start right away and ask you how you fell in love with writing.
I think I fell in love with reading first, probably like most authors. It was my love of books that eventually led to my love of writing. My first writing attempts that I can recall were seventh grade. My parents had just gotten divorced, and I had all these feelings and emotions, and I did not know what to do with them. And so I started writing really bad poetry that no one ever gets to read. But it was super cathartic and therapeutic, and it helped me really make sense and sort out where I was in my life and what was going on. I've done that with my writing ever since. I tend to write about themes that either interest me or that I'm grappling with. Hopefully both, where it's a world that I'm interested in or idea, but then maybe a question that I'm still trying to work out for myself.
Is there one book or one story idea that you came up with that you feel really closely connected to?
There's probably three. One would be my first book. It's not the story details. I don't want people to read it and think, oh my God, she did that. It's called Fakey 19, and all of the emotions, they're autobiographical. It's what I was going through in my senior year of high school and how I was just completely failing myself until I figured out a few things. So that's like an intensely personal book. Also, I would say Saving Zoe and Evermore. They're very different, but they were written around the same time. I was under contract to write Saving Zoe, but I was writing Evermore on the side, and I had just gone through a lot of grief and a lot of loss and lost all these people in a very short amount of time and almost lost my husband. So I was really struggling with that idea of grief and loss and what to do with that and what that looks like. And so I really approached it in two really different ways in Saving Zoe and Evermore. But a lot of myself is in both of those books.
First of all, I'm so sorry that you lost so many loved ones in your life at that moment. And second, That was really brave of you to share. Also very inspiring where you weaved these tragic moments and found therapy and created these books out of them. Did it almost feel spiritual, like you were connecting with some people that may have passed on?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. I don't want to make it sound like it was just one long dream, but there was a fever dream aspect to it. Of course, I did all my usual plotting and made my outline and all the usual steps that I take. But when I sat down to actually write, it was a really interesting flow to it that I don't experience with every book. There's something about the process where you feel like you're almost channeling. You know, sometimes you sit back and you're like, where did that come from?
It's like, damn, I'm a genius.
Yeah, or I had that range, you know. Go either way. I'd say with every book, by the time I start a book and I'm all excited and then I look at that first blank page and I always think, oh my God, how am I going to fill up this page, much less the 350 that have to follow? I don't even know that many words. Somehow I reach the end and I type the end and I think, how did that just happen? It's always a little bit of an experience like that. But with certain books, it's been especially strong where I felt like it almost came from somewhere else outside of me.
Did you end up dedicating those books to the ones that have passed on, or did you feel you were able to make a tribute in some way, shape, or form?
Let me think. Saving Zoe was a story about sisters. I dedicated it to my sisters, although it was actually inspired by two brothers, my husband's twin who passed away. I had dedicated another book that came out earlier to his twin. I was publishing pretty rapidly back then. And then Evermore, I think I dedicated that to an old friend of mine. It was definitely in there, and it was a really big part of it. All these people that had passed on in my life, I almost felt that they were part of that journey.
Do you find like there's just one theme that runs through all of your books, no matter if it's adult fiction or middle grade novels? Do you find anything that's always lingering there or stays there throughout all of your books?
Yeah, definitely. This message of you are enough. You are okay and you are enough. Despite what other people may tell you, you are enough and you deserve to be here. I was bullied as a kid, and so it was something that I struggled with back then. And I find that message, no matter what sort of book I'm writing, whether it's middle grade, fun, humorous adventure story, it's in there. It's really in every book in one way or another.
That is so positive. It's really great because you read these stories and you're going through this entire journey, but once you're finished with a book, you just walk away feeling so refreshed and feeling so good about yourself. And Allison, I would love to know, what is really exciting you most about your work right now?
You know, I've written two middle grades and that's been really, really fun. I did a middle grade series earlier. It was a spinoff of The Immortals and it's called the Riley Bloom series. I had so much fun with it and I had a little anxiety, not about agreeing to do it. I just was really excited to jump in. But as I sat before the screen and got ready to write that, I went to a little bit of a panicky meltdown mode where I was, I don't know how to write a 12-year-old. I've only written 16-year-olds. After a bit, calmed down and realized sort of the ridiculousness of that statement, like there's a mold for a 12-year-old and all I had to do was access that. When in fact, you just have to create a character that's believable that this character is like this at 12 years old. And I already knew who that character was. She had made an appearance in Evermore and I loved writing her. Once I just thought, I just have to recreate Riley, this character that I already adored. She just happens to be 12 and this is how she views the world. I had so much fun writing those books and then I went back to doing YA again. And of course, I love that. That's my first love. But I've written these two middle grade books. One is 5 Days of Famous. It's with Random House Delacorte. It'll be in stores this December 13. And the next one I just finished is The Bone Thief. And that'll be out October of 2017. And it's just such a fun time of life to get to re-experience through the characters. There's this lack of self-consciousness and there's this belief that you can do everything and it's so limitless and so much fun. So I've really been excited and enjoying that.
I love that you brought up how you realize, wait, I shouldn't think too much about trying to write in a mold for a 12-year-old, but just to be the character and just to write it the way she sees the world. Was there a muse where you were able to tap in that you're thinking of while writing the 12-year-old's character?
I'm not really a muse writer. I'm always interested in people that are, because it's not really a method that I relate to. I just immerse and jump in for that period of time while I'm at my computer. I am Riley Bloom, or I am Nick Dashaway, or a Grimsley Summerfield, or whatever character it is that I'm writing. I just sort of become that character. It's just a full-on, I liked how you said it, sort of boundary-dropping immersion into the mind of this person and what their experience is like, and seeing it through their eyes, and less of a outside thing. I'll cut clippings of pictures that might remind me of clothes that they'd wear, or what maybe their world looks like. And I'll make playlists and stuff like that to sort of help guide me into the experience. But really, they're just sort of a guidepost that leads me to that trail that I end up walking while I'm writing that character.
That was so awesome. You mentioned a playlist and clippings of things to just guide you in. I love that you're able to write it in a way where there are no walls around you and you just go with it, because I feel like that allows more flexibility. Keeping current with things that are more relatable, instead of like, what's a Tamagotchi? It's, oh, okay, they have the iPhone or something. Are you very aware of that?
Yeah, no, it's really story specific. 5 Days of Famous is super contemporary. Nick Dashaway is very much an almost 13-year-old living in this current world that, you know, likes a lot of the same things that 12 and 13-year-olds are really into today. And his world is really, really realistic and contemporary. Whereas The Bone Thief is a complete fantasy world. So yeah, it's world specific, but I try to keep up to a certain extent. And it also, I think, helps you form the idea for characters too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Where do these ideas of these characters kick in? And from there, how do you then realize them into a fully developed character?
It's almost a process that I can't always fully explain, because it just sort of happens. Usually it starts with a story premise idea. It usually comes first. It's usually something really loose that I don't even know if it can be a story. 5 Days of Famous was kind of based on this survey that they had taken with young kids, and it was like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And an overwhelming amount said famous. And I thought, wow, you know, interesting and a little disturbing. But I thought it would be interesting to explore that. Yeah, a kid that's what he wants, because he thinks it's going to correct all of his current issues in his life and give him that. Usually it's the premise. And then I think, okay, well, who would be the least able to handle this well? Who's the least suited for this? Because I don't want to take a character that's just going to walk into the spotlight and just own it. And take someone who wants it very badly, but they're not at all ready for it.
Could we use Unrivaled as an example too for your characters and character development?
That was really fun. Again, it deals a lot with fame and the underbelly of fame and ambition. You've got really different approaches to it. You have Layla that is blogging as a Hollywood blogger and filled with self-loathing for it because she hates the world that she's writing about. She's saying, well, I'm 18 years old and I'm self-supporting because of it. And my dad struggles financially. And because I do this, I don't have to ask him for help and put that burden on him. And her whole goal is to go to journalism school and someday be very serious and respected like Christian Amanpour. And then there's Tommy, who he just really, really wants to perform music and be taken seriously. But he also mostly wants to be taken seriously by the father, who doesn't even realize he's alive. And then there's Aster. She's more of a princess type, a little more shallow in the beginning, and she really just wants to be a star. And I don't know if she even has a really good concrete reason why. She just wants that. She wants to forge her own path and not live the path that her parents want for her. So they all have a surface reason and a deeper reason for why they want to do what they want to do. And they're all approaching it in very different ways.
Was that challenging for you to write? Because that's quite a few characters that you're really fleshing out with all these different goals, motives. And do you organize yourself with index cards, outlines, or character sheets? How do you stay organized?
That was like a really big puzzle, because you have the three characters I mentioned, and then you have Madison, Brooks, and another character. So you have their four perspectives. And then every now and then you get another perspective in there, the journalist Trina, and they're all telling different parts of the story. And so it was really a lot to juggle. That was a really big challenge in that book, but I handled it how I always handle my books. I'm really big on screenwriting process. Robert McKee's book Story was amazing. And I just went to one of his seminars last weekend. And I used Blake Snyder's Save the Cat. I always start with a loose outline. I use the Save the Cat beat sheet. I find it enormously helpful because invariably with every single book I've ever written, I will get to the middle and I will be lost in the forest of words and I'll start hating everything and thinking I'm a failure, my career's about to blow up because I've written myself into a mess. And when I get to that point, which I will, I can refer back to that beat sheet.
So it's like bumpers for writing.
It is. Yeah, it keeps me on track. It keeps me from going too crazy. It's the major turning points and events throughout that are going to happen throughout the book. And so anytime I start to get lost, I can just refer back to that and say, no, all is well, you're right here, or you wrote way out of track here. You got to get back on track and get over here. That is a lifesaver, and especially in a book of the scope of Unrivaled. And I just finished the second book, Blacklist, which is going to be out next April. I am right now into writing the final book, Infamous. So I'm right in the thick of that.
Wow, you are killing it. So now you're writing all these books. How are you crunching with the deadline? How is that going for you?
By this point, I'm pretty disciplined and I stick to a daily word count, depending on how much time I have and the scope of the book. A few years ago, I had just come off a four-year period where I wrote 14 books and traveled to six continents and moved, and everything happened in those 4 years, and I was so burnt out. And so wow. I just finished the final Soul Seekers book, and I took a year off. I didn't write at all, and I completely dropped out of even keeping up with industry stuff, and I just let it all go because I really needed a break. I traveled. I went somewhere different every month.
Oh my gosh. Can you tell us some places that you went to? I love traveling.
The final big trip was Peru. We travel a lot, but that was definitely a highlight trip of my life.
Did you see any alpacas?
Oh my gosh, tons.
So
just wandering around Machu Picchu. It was absolutely amazing experience. And I actually ended up doing a book signing in Lima.
Oh my God. Okay. So it worked out perfectly. Just be like, it's a work trip.
I did a mini signing. I met with some readers in Cusco, which is a small village that you go to right before you go to Machu Picchu to adjust to the altitude. You need to stay there a couple days to get adjusted. And I had some readers there. And so they came to my hotel and I did a little mini signing for them. It was a really cool experience to be able to do that because it's sort of off the beaten book tour path.
How awesome is that? I don't know if you even expected to have readers there. Did you? Or did you already know you had a market?
I mean, I knew I had some readers there, but I think she got in touch with me on Twitter because she saw that I was going to be in Peru and we just sort of connected. She met me at the hotel. It was really great. That year off amounted to a three-year break between books because I had to write the next book and then the year that it takes to go through the process. So I had sort of a three-year break between my last book and Unrivaled. Going back to your question, I feel pretty good about the deadlines. I feel like I'm in a place now where I'm writing at a pace that I can keep up with without having a meltdown.
I think it's so amazing that you mentioned that because a lot of writers put a lot of pressure on themselves about needing to make a certain deadline and also needing to write a very specific amount of words per day, which I do agree if you have a contract, but at the same time, you need to know that you are the only one in charge of your own health and mental state. So if you're feeling very burnt out and exhausted, it's good to give yourself permission and it's good to step away and take control and responsibility of your own mental state.
Yeah, I mean, and you have to refill the well too. I was traveling a lot for book tours and stuff, but a lot of that time was spent in interviews or school visits or, you know, bookstores or in front of my computer. You need to actually live a life if you want to write about people living a life.
That's true.
It was a good opportunity to just recoup and feed the well and kind of get excited about telling stories and getting new ideas for new stories.
Oh, absolutely. Talking about traveling, have you done literary pilgrimages? Whether you just want to be in that town, that city, that country of one of your favorite authors and just feeling inspired or just for research?
I've done research traveling. Yeah, for sure. For Bone Thief, just last March, we were in Prague for an event and went to the Bone Cathedral just outside of Prague. The imagery of that played a big part into scenes in The Bone Thief and also some stuff that we did in Vienna as well. And for the Soul Seekers, I went to New Mexico where it takes place and did a lot of research for that. I love being able to do that under the excuse of research.
I love that. Were there moments where you were not able to travel due to your schedule and instead did research via Google Images and reading articles?
I'm pretty sure I've traveled to the actual locations for all of them. Although sometimes maybe it has been a while since I've been there and I can't get back right away. So then I'll rely on Googling and Google Earth and things like that to see what's changed and to try to keep what I know current.
I am super curious now because I travel a lot and there are moments where I just feel so swept away by inspiration. For you, do you take down notes or do you record things in voice notes and bring it back to America and then hash it out?
I don't really write while I travel. I don't do well with that. When I'm traveling, I just want to be out seeing all the things, you know. But generally, I just want to be out doing things. So I just take a lot of pictures and I will keep a journal and receipts and mementos and brochures and whatever and just keep that all bundled together. And then later on when I get home, I can just unpack that and see if there's something actually useful there or if I was just swept away in the moment, which sometimes happens.
I totally feel you over there. So for those who may not be familiar with your newest books, could you give them a little snapshot of the world you created?
Sure. So Unrivaled is book one in my new series called The Beautiful Idol series. And it is in stores now. It was a really fun book for me to write because after writing a ton of paranormals and fantasies in a row, I got to go back to my contemporary roots. It takes place in LA. And it really delves into the underlying more gritty interior beneath that glossy, glamorous LA dream. It's about ambition and greed and competition. It's about three teens that are all have a goal that they really want to reach and need to reach for various reasons. And so they enter a competition that promises a big cash prize that'll fuel and fund all of their dreams. But the choices that they make in their competitive heat end up making them suspects when the It Girl starlet Madison Brooks goes missing. Each book picks up exactly where the next one left off. Unrivaled left off on a bit of a cliffhanger, I might say. But Blacklist will just pick up right where that started. And they're really mysteries at core, but it also has that fun, gossipy LA reality TV show kind of feel to it as well. I think they're a really fun read and sort of dishy and gossipy and glammy. And I've had a lot of fun writing them. I hope people like reading them too. And then the middle grade books that I told you about earlier, 5 Days of Famous, will be out in December. It's about super nerdy Nick Dashaway, who is tired of being an invisible nobody. He's convinced that the path to popularity and to gaining the notice of the girl of his dreams is by becoming famous. And so he makes a play to win the Green Tree Talent Show. And when that fails, his wish is granted in an unexpected way when he boards a mysterious Christmas trolley in the middle of a blizzard. And he ends up in an alternate world where he is the number one teen idol in the world. And wow. He has to see if the dream is all it's cracked up to be.
With these two books, what were the most challenging scenes that you had to grapple with? And how did you navigate your way through that?
I think for Unrivaled, it was because it's a mystery. It's building that mystery and putting in all the pieces that will pay off somewhat in this book and then also later down the line. I mean, when you're writing a mystery, it all has to pay off. Everything you put in there is a setup for something later on, whether it ends up being a red herring or an actual clue. So there's a really big sort of puzzle element to that. That was a bit of a challenge. With 5 Days, I think it was just trying to keep the voice fresh and aspirational and believable since I was writing a boy.
That's so awesome to know about these scenes. And also, I'm wondering, because you've written so many books, so please tell me you're human and that you have the first draft of your manuscript written, but then you're feeling very stuck from there and you don't know where to take it.
Yeah, I feel that way with every single book I've ever written.
Oh, yeah, you're just like us. You're human.
Yes, for sure. I think the key, though, is to take the pressure off of yourself because the fact is it's a first draft and it's not going to be good. It's just not. It's not going to be good. It's not going to be polished. It's not going to be together. And you're certainly not going to submit that, or at least I hope you don't. So right there, the moment you know that you're not going to submit that, nobody's going to read that, it's for you to find your way through the story. That first draft is your opportunity to make tons of mistakes, to make a big old mess, to use your delete key liberally, and to figure out what it really is that you want to say. What is the story really about? Where are you really going? Why does this matter? And all of that is stuff that you're gonna start to figure out in the first draft. And then you're gonna really become more and more clear with each subsequent drafts. So yeah, I certainly feel that way because all of us have a little bit of that, oh, I want this to be perfect kind of thing, but it's just not going to be. And it never actually will be. You just get to a point where that's the best you could do at that given time, you know?
No, that's super helpful. Then moving from that to the next phase where we are starting to realize, okay, we need to share this because we need to start getting more feedback and needing to know how to shape this more. How do you then find a consistency in your voice or your language or your character choices?
A couple things about that. I don't feel like the voice really finds its way until several drafts in. You know, you have a better idea where the story is going and who these characters are and the choices that they would logically make considering who they are and how they're going to react to them. And that's all going to inform the voice. So that may not come until a little bit later in the process. So again, take the pressure off and just write really bad, stiff dialogue. It's okay. You know,
yes.
It's a placeholder. You're going to delete it and fix it later. But one of the things that really helped me early on, it's interesting because I've kind of come full circle with it. But when I was trying to sell Faking 19, everybody rejected it, and rightfully so, because it was terrible. But I got the same feedback from every agent and every editor, and it was great voice, like nothing happens. I had a girl wandering around thinking deep thought, not exactly a page turner. One person told me to read Robert McKee's story, which I highly recommend, and by page 30, I knew what I was doing wrong. And
oh, wow.
I finished his book. And then my husband and I used to live in New York, and we had one long weekend in New York, and we printed the book and we separated chapter by chapter, and we had it all laid out on my apartment floor. And I went through each chapter and I saw, does this scene change? Does something happen in this scene? What is the value change in this scene? Do we go from happy to sad or failure to success, or even if it's a minimal change? And if the scene didn't change, I forced myself to make it matter or I got rid of it. And I did that, and I went back to an agent who had expressed some interest if I was willing to work on it, and he signed me, and that got the book sold. And it kind of came full circle because I read a lot of books on craft, and right now I'm reading Sean Coyne's book, The Story Grid, and he talks about doing exactly that. And I was like, oh my God, that's what I did for Faking 19. And that's what got me the sell, is because nothing happened, because I had all these scenes where there was really no change in value. She was just sort of staying stagnant. It wasn't the good, compelling commercial fiction journey. That made a huge difference for me. So I really suggest and I think it helps with the dead spots too, because the dead spots means, to me, that translates to this is sort of meh and nothing's really going on. So look at that scene and ask, where is my character at the start of the scene? Where is my character at the end of the scene? And if there isn't some sort of change, even if it's subtle, it doesn't have to be huge, ask yourself why. What's the point of the scene? Can you make it matter? And if you can't, consider getting rid of it.
Thank you a million times over. That was very detailed and it was very much appreciated. And I think that's going to really get a lot of conversation going with the listeners. And then from there, you were able to figure that out for yourself. And I heard you say that your husband was with you laying it out.
Yeah, he's my reader. Yeah. He went to the McKee seminar with me. He knows story structure and he knows the craft of it. And he's not a writer, he's an attorney, but he's got a great eye for detail, so he can point out all the inconsistencies. And then he's really good at the structure, really knowledgeable about it. So he's always my first reader. I always give it to him before I give it to my editor, and he gives me his feedback.
That's amazing. What an amazing you know, it's so important. And I always try to highlight this too, where you have to have a support system, a really strong support system that really looks out for you and just has all good intentions for you. And my goodness, I'm so happy you have that in your husband. You know, there's a lot of people out there whose spouses don't understand why they're even pursuing arts in the first place. So that's really depressing, where I'm just like, oh gosh, it's not even you holding yourself back, but the one that you're in love with. I love hearing personal stories like this. It just reminds me of me and my girlfriend. I'm doing all this podcasting, and do you know she's not a writer? You know, I mentioned that she's opening up a cafe restaurant. She's right. going to be jumping in with me to do NaNoWriMo this year for the first time ever. And she's going to commit to try and write 50,000 words. That is so sweet of her, because she's trying to understand my journey. And I thought it'd be like a fun way to connect in that way. So it's so good to have those around you.
That is going to be a great experience for you guys. It is. I think that is just so charming that she's doing that. And I think it's going to help her get a better understanding of what you try to do and what your struggles are. And neuroticism of a writer.
Yeah, right. So it's like, if I'm ever locked up holding myself away, she'll be like, oh, okay, I get it. She's doing her thing. You know what I'm saying? I'm locked up, holed up, doing all this podcasting, trying to write and all that stuff. And she's just in the corner helping me edit the episodes, the first round in story editing, and then feeding me food and just being so supportive. And I just can't imagine how much more supportive she'll be after this NaNoWriMo experience. So I'm very excited for that. I think soon, hopefully, we'll follow in your footsteps, yours and your husband's, where she'll help me lay out the note cards on the floor as well to look at the storyline. Oh my gosh, that's awesome. But yeah, next step, I definitely have to grab that Robert McKee's book.
And check out Sean Coyne's Story Grid, which I'm in the middle of, and I'm loving it. And also Save the Cat, Lake Snyder. That's sort of my holy trinity of things that I have on my desk at all times.
I want to know, with all your books, how do you think you've evolved creatively?
Oh, wow. Sometimes I wish I could access that part of me when I was working on Fakie 19 that didn't know as much as I now know about the business end of it, and that I could just be as naive and green and full of mistakes as I was back then. But at the same time, knowing what I know and the journey, and, you know, and I've been all over the place. I've been a debut author. I've been an author that was selling well enough to get the next contract, but not a bestseller. I've been a number one New York Times International bestseller. I've been through all the phases. I know what every part of this business looks like. I've been struggling for the next idea. But I think the more books I write, hopefully you improve your game with each book. And I always try to do that by keeping up on new writing books that might be interesting to me, or that, and a lot of the times I'm reading the same thing again, but it might strike me in a new way. So that makes it helpful. But I'm always just trying to reach to communicate more clearly.
I love you. You're just one of those people who, no matter how successful and how accomplished you are, you always want to learn. And I really admire people like you who have that instilled. That's really a great characteristic to have, an attribute. You're so freaking awesome. I also would love to ask you, what is the hardest or most difficult moment in your life that you came across where you felt really stuck and you couldn't get out of that situation?
I mean, I've had tons of stuck moments, and I'm really grateful for those moments, because every time I've come up against that wall that was so frustrating, and I was just not living how I wanted to live or not feeling the way I wanted to feel, the tendency is to stay there. You know, because change is scary for most of us, for all of us, really. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's better the devil you know, and this is, it's not making me happy, but it's a safe place. I lived in Mykonos, Greece once in my 20s, and people would be like, you know, oh, you're living in paradise. And yeah, I mean, it was absolutely beautiful. It was great. But 7 years into it, I was so comfortable, but I was thinking, this is not where I want to be in 7 more years, you know? And I forced myself to leave. And I ended up in New York City, and I was a flight attendant for Delta Airlines. I mean, it was just like a complete life change. I went from a tiny island to living in New York City. I liked it. I met great people. I didn't like the job. I liked the benefits of the job. And I met great people, and I loved living in New York City. But, you know, I was just sort of treading water. The dream was always to write. And then 9/11 happened, and I was based in New York City and got big pay cuts and had to look for bombs on the airplane. And I thought, what are you doing? And that was the trigger to begin writing. So it's usually I hit this point of extreme frustration, And the choice is to either stay there or reach for something else. Luckily, so far, I've always chosen to reach for the next thing. And it's always a little scary in the beginning. I mean, I definitely kept my day job while I was first publishing. I think I quit flying when I got my second or third contract. So I wanted to be secure enough that I could felt like I could afford to quit, like that would be not as risky. So I've always been very pragmatic as far as keeping the day job while I'm pursuing the other thing. But I think it's really important to take the leap. I really do. I'm a big believer in taking the leap because I just don't want to regret and wonder at the end of my life what could have happened if I had I not taken the leap. I'd still be living in Mykonos right now.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people are like, hell yes, I would take that opportunity anytime. I totally get that. I'm a firm believer in that too, where I've done that where I'm just like, I feel so stuck and it's so comfortable, but other people are like, what an amazing life. And I'm like, okay, I get it, but I'm not feeling the excitement. I'm not feeling alive. You know, I think that word alive is so important to carry you through for the rest of your life. I picture myself on my deathbed. And I'm like, do I want to look back when I'm however old and think I shouldn't have spent so much time on doing that specific thing or worrying about what that person's thinking or if I'm offending somebody? Do I want to spend the rest of my life doing that to the point where I'm on the deathbed and then boom, that's it? No, I don't. Absolutely not. And that is what motivates me as well. So I really relate to you in that way. That's amazing.
Look at those moments when everybody went through that moment of grief. It took the while and going through the adjustment of the grief and stuff. But I try to look back on any moment like that and think, you know, what was the lesson? What is a lesson that I can take from that? Instead of feeling like this victim, that this terrible thing happened to me, it happens to a lot of people. It's not just me. I'm not the only one that went through something like that. And it's someday we're lucky enough to live long enough, we're going to have that moment repeatedly. Is we lose people. So I always try to look at it like, what is a lesson here? What can I take from that? How can I do better with that? And I think that helps us keep you propelling forward instead of staying stuck in that one place.
Oh, I love that. Okay, not to sound all life coach on you, but my goodness, you need to go around to conferences and have your own speaking engagements about life overall and how writing has really given you new lives over and over again. I seriously pulled a Tony Robbins on you, but I mean, you are very inspiring, not with your writing only, but in addition to that, your life journey and the way you live your life, the way you see things, your perspective is very, very refreshing. Give me a snapshot of your lifestyle being a flight attendant and writing. What was that like?
I was writing everywhere. I was writing on cocktail napkins. I would get an idea for dialogue or whatever, you know, and I would jot it down. I was writing while I was sitting on my jump seat ready for takeoff. I can say that now because I'm not afraid of getting fired anymore. I mean, writers are always writing, but I always had these little notebooks or scraps of paper or whatever, and I would furiously jot down ideas and notes and dialogue, and definitely on layover, especially the more boring layovers, you know, the ones I do a million times in the crummy hotel, I would definitely spend that time writing. So it was just whenever I could fit it in, whatever pocket of time I could fit it in. And that was like a 2.5 year journey of making the decision. I am sick of burning daylight and I'm going to go after this dream. And if I fail, at least I tried. It was 2.5 years of that decision to finally getting that first book deal. So it can take a while. And I know, I feel like people are always in such a rush to make the dream come true immediately. Good things are worth waiting for. And for me, I had no idea how hard it would be. And if I did at that point in my life, I probably would have said, oh, maybe it's not for me then. Maybe I'm just not good enough for that. But I didn't know. And I was so naive and green. And I just went out there with my terrible manuscript thinking, oh, who should I pick to publish this? And all of those rejections were, at the time, they're horrible. They feel so personal and so just soul destroying. But looking back, which I have the luxury of doing now, it really made me prove how bad did I want this. And I kind of got stubborn, like, I'll show you. I only need one, yes, I don't need 10, and I will get that, and I will show you. And so I kind of, it brought out this real stubbornness in me in this, and that really helped. And it helps you down the line because everyone thinks once you get the book deal, you're done. And No, there's a whole other group of people lined up waiting to reject you. Helps toughen you up and getting you ready for that process.
You are so badass. Just so you could have a glimpse of how I think, I'm just like, wow, how did you not lose any of those cocktail napkins with those stories that you jotted down? It's so inspiring, your whole journey. For me, I would probably spill water or juice on it. You need to write a movie based on your, I'm so bossy right now. Girl, this is what you need to do. You better write this down. Okay. So you really need to write a screenplay about your life, especially when you were being a flight attendant, running back and forth all these countries, in the nook and crannies, finding spaces to find time to write on your cocktail napkins and wherever, however, to make your stories happen. What? That is such an amazing film. I would be the first in line to watch that. I would love to ask you, what is your proudest moment in your career?
There are so many, but one in particular just came to mind where a boy got chosen for Make-A-Wish. His wish was to have a signed copy of Evermore. And it was the letter I received and the information I received from him. It was one of the most touching things that happened. And it was very gratifying because that series was written from a place of great loss. And that loss surrounded with cancers. And this boy was in that same predicament. And that's all he wanted. That was his wish. I mean, he could have wished for anything. So, of course, I sent him the entire series signed in a card. I think about him every now and then. And don't know what became of him. But wherever he is, he's near to my heart. That was a big moment and a very unexpected sort of thing.
Thank you for sharing that. That is beautiful. I can't even imagine getting a request like that. That says so much about you and your work. It's touching so many people's lives. I know you have your books coming up that you're working on. They're coming out soon. Anything else you want us to check out?
I'm super excited about furthering and wrapping up the Beautiful Idols series. Like I said, Unrivaled is in stores now. Blacklist is in production. It'll be in stores in April of next year, followed by Infamous, which I'm writing right now. I have two middle grades coming out, 5 Days of Famous this December. Great Christmas gift. It centers during Christmas time. And a lot of fun writing it. And also The Bone Thief next October. And I'm just sort of in this period where I am trying to decide what I want to do next. And nice. I've got a couple ideas that I'm playing with. And so we'll see where it goes.
And that wraps up our episode with the amazing Allison Noel. Allison, thank you for being so generous with our storyteller community. I really loved chatting with you. Storytellers, thank you for listening in and joining us. I hope Allison's stories and sage advice gives you a boost of inspiration. Please say hi to Allison over on Twitter at Allison Noel. She also mentions really helpful resources in her episode, and they're all linked up in her show notes page over at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/AllisonNoel. Don't forget to join our brand new Facebook group if you're looking for a safe space to check in with your writing. Come hang out with us over at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. At the very top of the show, I mentioned Vermont College of Fine Arts. I know there's a lot of you who are really interested in writing books for children or young adults, so you'll definitely want to pay special attention to what Vermont College of Fine Arts has to offer. VCFA has 3 different graduate level programs for writers, and I'll be going into detail about their program called Writing for Children and Young Adults. Students meet up twice a year on their gorgeous campus in the heart of historic Montpelier in Vermont for intensive 10-day residencies. It's a lot like a 10-day retreat for writers, and you guys know how much I love retreats. Imagine attending VCFA's MFA program where you'll be immersed in an amazing writing community filled with intensive workshops, lectures, panel discussions, and readings that are always challenging and inspiring you. After the life-changing experiences at the residencies, you and the faculty will design your own course for the start of the semester by really zoning in on your specific writing goals. Throughout the semester, you'll continue working with faculty mentors through telephone conferences, emails, and letters. So basically, you're receiving one-on-one mentorship throughout your semester as you take control in shaping the kind of education you want out of your time with VCFA. Check out 88cupsoftea.com/VCFA for more info. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!